Show.
It is Friday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Coming up, another Syrian city falls to the Islamic State militants.
This isn't necessarily going so well, but the truth is, to reverse this course will continue to take a commitment that the international community has been unwilling to give up until now.
Opposition campaigns continue up to the deadline in Ethiopia's election. Also ahead, what's happening with British pop star Sam Smith. Islamic State takeover of Palmyra, Syria, one of the region's most valuable World Heritage Sites, may have been a huge military victory for the group as it gains a major weapons cache, an airport, and a prison packed with jihadis. Some analysts, however, say the swift takeover may also have been in part a calculated strategic loss for the Syrian government as it fights rebel forces Damascus considers a greater threat than the Islamic State. VOA's Heather Murdock reporting from the VOA Middle East Bureau.
An amateur video posted on a social website Thursday shows what appears to be a gas field near Palmyra. This man in the video, presumably an Islamic State fighter, makes vague threats against Gulf Arab people and Alawites, the sect of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and the video shows a car driving on a road to Palmyra. The Islamic State group the same day announced on Twitter that it had taken over the city, which includes a military base believed to house massive amounts of weaponry, an airport, and a prison. Mario Abu Zaid, a researcher for the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, says jihadis from all over Syria were being held in that prison, and it could be a source of future recruits.
This also will give access to the Islamic State to free some new jihadists and people who are kept in those prisons and use them to their own advantage.
The loss of Palmyra was a major blow to the government, which was controlling the city, essentially cutting their land route from the capital Damascus to government-held eastern cities. Zaid says the fall of Palmyra demonstrates the growing weakness of the government, army, and Iranian-backed militias fighting rebel groups. But he says there could also have been a strategic element to the withdrawal.
The Assad regime would rather pave the way for the Islamic State rather than surrendering any city or any facility for the opposition.
The Assad government considers rebel groups a greater threat than the Islamic State, Zaid says. He also says that looking forward, Mr. Assad could be protecting his interests because he is an enemy of both the rebels and the Islamic State. The United States-led coalition is fighting ISIS, as the Islamic State is known, but supporting the rebels. According to Zaid, if a city falls to the Islamic State, Mr. Assad may have help getting it back. Help from abroad, however, doesn't seem to be working as the Islamic State group continues to gain ground in both Iraq and Syria, having taken Ramadi, an Iraqi provincial capital, just days before, says Chatham House analyst Tim Eaton.
When we see the events of recent days in Ramadi and now in Palmyra, we see that this isn't necessarily going so well, but the truth is, to reverse this course will continue to take a commitment that the international community has been unwilling to give up until now. So I think that obviously events such as Palmyra really highlight these issues and also highlight the fact that the strategy isn't working.
Palmyra is home to one of the region's most important heritage sites, home to art and artifacts going back thousands of years. ISIS has previously boosted its publicity by destroying ancient treasures and posting videos of the destruction online. Heather Murdock, VOA News, Cairo.
And now we turn to VOA's Jeff Young, who speaks with Professor Gareth Stansfield at the University of Exeter and the Royal United Services Institute for more on what the takeover of Palmyra means.
Dr. Stansfield, this is a place that is filled with antiquities. It's an archaeological treasure, and now it's been taken over by the Islamic State. What are the inherent dangers of having an insurgent group like this holding such a priceless World Heritage Site?
The issue with Palmyra is that it is a very notable and important historical archaeological a cultural center, so it's a loss to humanity in general, but it is destroyed. It's also an important focal point for the economy of that particular part of central Syria. But most importantly, I think, in terms of the security of the region, is that it's located right at the heart of the main road that links the west of Syria to the east. And this does open up the possibility that places to the west, including Damascus and other places that run along the Lebanese border, could become increasingly threatened by ISIS. Also, what's important to note is that there is a very large prison in the town of Tadmor, which neighbours Palmyra. And this prison is one of the places that the Syrian regime houses most of its notorious anti-regime prisoners. And it's very likely indeed that there'll be some very formidable recruits for ISIS that they're now able to release from that prison.
I see a certain diabolical brilliance in their taking Palmyra because it is so old and so fragile, you cannot respond to the Islamic State with any sort of full-bore military response. If you drop bombs or run artillery, you have priceless buildings from thousands of years ago that fall down and crumble. So in a sense, they picked a good place to embed themselves because a military response doesn't seem to be as feasible as it would be in other circumstances. What do you think?
Well, the geography of Palmyra is very much divided. The ancient city lies outside the modern town. So there is a modern town of tens of thousands of people that really are not getting all that much attention, really. And one has to feel for the inhabitants of Palmyra, of Tadmor today. But the actual ancient city is not part of the modern city. Now, if ISIS chooses to use it as a military ground in the defense of Palmyra later on, that's one thing. But there is no immediate reason why American or any other air force would feel the need to attack the actual ancient city itself at this point.
Gareth Stansfield is a professor at the University of Exeter, and he was speaking with my colleague, Jeff Young. Here's VOA's Michael Lippin with what they're saying on social media sites about what's happening in Palmyra.
Thanks, Steve. The situation in Palmyra is getting lots of reaction from our readers on various platforms. On Twitter, a user with the handle @SantasTavern commented on a VOA web report from Thursday titled "Islamic State Poised to Seize Huge Syrian Arms Depot." Well, that's a reference to the government arms depot near the ancient ruins of the Syrian city. The Santas Tavern Twitter user called for the Islamic State to be stopped from getting its hands on the weapons, writing, "One can only hope that the Syrian government has rigged the depot to blow up." The VOA web report that I just mentioned also has had at least 12 comments posted at the bottom of the article. Here's one of them from Bill Webb in the U.S. city of Phoenix, Arizona. "Although many countries have signed on to the anti-Islamic State coalition, the U.S. has done more through its bombing campaign than any other. U.S. ground troops should be out of the question. It's the affected surrounding countries who must complete the destruction of IS to ensure the sovereignty of Iraq and Syria." And that's the view of Bill Webb. Another comment came from a reader who goes by the name My News Clips, and that person wrote, "Why should we care for the ruins of Palmyra when we didn't care about Syrian President Assad's killing of thousands of women and children using chemical bombs with the full support of so-called civilized nations like Russia?" And we've also had comments on the Palmyra article coming in on the Voice of America Facebook page. Facebook user Fahad Nasir Santu wrote, "What is the President of the United States doing about this? He must save this site from these non-human creatures who are ruining every dignity of humanity." Well, that comment drew a response from Dwayne Fitzhugh, who wrote this, "Why must the U.S. be the world's savior? You speak of the U.S. President, yet you are forgetting we as citizens do not want to get involved in your conflict." Well, that's a look at some of our audience's feedback on the Palmyra story. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, Michael. You can follow Michael on Twitter. His handle is @Michael_Lippin. I'm also on Twitter. You can find me @VOA Norman.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
Almost 37 million Ethiopians can vote this Sunday in the country's national election, although Ethiopia's current government is expected to easily win the poll for the fifth time. Opposition parties are still campaigning in a last hope to win some votes. Marta van der Wolf has more now from Addis Ababa.
58 political parties are contesting Ethiopia's national election Sunday, May 24. It is widely expected that the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front Party, EPRDF, which has been in power since 1991, will win the vote. But opposition parties and their members, such as the Blue Party, are still campaigning. 23-year-old art student Lul Damtu is one of them.
The current government opposes another parties. It's monopoly, socially, politically, and also religious. So I'm so annoyed. So I will join the Blue Party.
Eight big trucks drive through every neighborhood in the capital, Addis Ababa. The dozens of Blue Party supporters, mostly in their 20s and 30s, are standing on those trucks while giving flyers to passers-by or to those standing in line for taxis. When the Blue Party encounters a ruling party truck, it seems they are competing over who has the loudest sound system, each blasting campaign slogans and Ethiopian music. Standing on a truck and waving a flag with the party symbol of three circles is 28-year-old Blue Party volunteer Ephraim Sahaile Selassie. He says he knows his party will not win the elections.
Joseph Stalin, the Russian leader, once said that it's not the votes which decide. It is the person who counts that vote. So in this case, I have my own worries because I have many doubts about the fairness of this election.
The ruling party won the last Ethiopian elections in 2010 with all but one seat in parliament. Despite government claims these elections will be free and fair, most opposition parties have accused the government of harassing and intimidating their members. Human rights organizations have frequently criticized Ethiopia for repressing dissenting voices. Negust Wondefrou is a 26-year-old housewife who joined the opposition party 2 years ago. She helps with public relations and organizing events because she opposes the government's policy. She says the ruling party's ethnic-based politics are her main problem because they are racist. Ethiopia's federal system is divided into 9 regional states based on ethnicity. The Blue Party, or Samayawi in Amharic, runs on the ideology of the liberal democracy. They are against the current ethnic federal system, saying that the ethnicity is used and the system does not include everyone. Samayawi is Ethiopia's youngest party, formed in 2012. Although the party had registered 400 candidates for the national elections, the National Electoral Board rejected 260 candidates, including their party leader. The board explained that the registered candidates were also members of another party, which is against the National Electoral Board's regulation. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Ivory Coast's main opposition party, the Ivorian Popular Front of former President Laurent Gbagbo, held a massive gathering late Thursday to choose a candidate for presidential elections in October. Head of the party, also known as the FPI, told everyone President Alassane Ouattara must go. Gbagbo's refusal to concede defeat to Mr. Ouattara after the elections in 2010 sparked a bloody 5-month standoff. Later on in the program, a look at a new medical trial about TB. Hope you'll stay with us. News update is straight ahead.
Here are the headlines from VOA. Observers say Islamic State captured the last Syrian-controlled border crossing between Syria and Iraq. According to the British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, Syrian forces fled the Al-Tanaf crossing, giving the militants control of the border. The monitors say Islamic State now controls about half of Syria after seizing the ancient city of Palmyra. Malaysia ordered Navy ships to begin searching for boat people in the first official move to save the thousands of persecuted Muslim Rohingya and Bangladeshi economic migrants believed to be adrift at sea. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe says that both sides of the Ukrainian conflict have been violating the terms of the ceasefire agreement. The top prosecutor in the eastern U.S. state of Maryland says all six officers charged in the police custody death of an African-American man in Baltimore have now been indicted by a grand jury. I'm Ray Kugel, VOA News.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. A clinical trial to test a new treatment for extensively drug-resistant TB, also known as XDR-TB, is underway in South Africa. The nonprofit TB Alliance and its partners launched the new study called NIX-TB. Dr. Mel Spiegelman is president of the Global Alliance for TB Drug and Development, and he explains to VOA's Kim Lewis why the new treatment regimen has the potential for long-term benefits.
The big difference is the ability to take new drugs that all have not yet been approved, and in fact only one of the three has been approved for TB, and after doing quite a bit of preclinical work, taking them and using them together. It really is an attempt to leapfrog what otherwise would take probably decades of work if one were to do it in a more conventional manner of getting each drug approved and only then beginning to study them together.
As it stands now, people with XDR-TB, they can be on treatment for 2 years or longer with thousands of pills and injections. What makes this treatment for XDR-TB different from what is going on right now?
So first of all, in the vast majority of cases, XDR-TB is not cured, just to be clear. One of the latest studies showed that, in fact, if you follow these patients long enough, perhaps as little as 15% of them may be cured with the presently available treatments. So it's a pretty grim prognosis for anyone who has XDR-TB. The duration of therapy that we expect in the animal models that we've used, this treatment can actually cure in about 3 months. We will be treating patients for 6 months, and for those who have a good response but don't appear to be cured at 6 months, we would go on with treatment for another three.
Where is the study going to be conducted?
The study is starting at three centers in South Africa. Because of the really experimental nature of the work, we are starting relatively slowly to make sure that we don't have any unanticipated side effects or problems. So we're starting slowly in three centers in South Africa, and then we intend to expand it after we get some initial experience with the regimen.
Why is XDR-TB so difficult to treat?
The major reason is because there's been so little investment in finding new treatments for TB that we don't have many new therapies, hardly any at all. And the old ones, just like the case in so many other infections, so many patients have become resistant, or the bugs have become resistant to the old treatments. So it's a combination of having outdated therapies and the lack of investment in trying to find new therapies. And that's why we get resistance that is virtually untreatable. This is not different or that different from what's really we're beginning to see in a lot of other infections where resistance is really becoming a major problem.
If the trials are successful, what is the next step?
The next step is twofold, or really threefold. The first next step, if the trial is successful, is to register this treatment so that it can be used in XDR patients worldwide, and to get that done as quickly as possible so that, in fact, we have a treatment for XDR-TB patients. The second step would be if the treatment is both efficacious enough and safe enough to actually then look at whether this would be a good treatment for multi-drug resistant TB who are not as resistant as the extensively resistant TB, which is XDR, and potentially even drug-sensitive TB, because what we're really trying to find is excellent short treatment that would be applicable to all patients with active TB and not even have to do what's called drug sensitivity testing and could treat all patients with the same very short regimen. In addition to that, if this treatment really is successful, we would be continuously looking at bringing in even newer and better drugs to further decrease the duration of therapy.
Will it be expensive for countries to acquire the treatment?
It really should not be, because each of the drugs that we're working with are really not that expensive to make at all. The big question when you get into treatments like this is really the volume, because the actual cost of manufacturing is very much dependent on how much is being manufactured. And if this is a treatment that can be widely used, then the actual cost of the drugs should really be very modest. And certainly the cost to the healthcare systems would go down dramatically by virtue of having an oral treatment, easy to administer, no hospitalization, no injectables, and all of those benefits.
That is Dr. Mel Spiegelman. He's president of the Global Alliance for TB Drug and Development. He was speaking with Kim Lewis, host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
He is a singer-songwriter. He's also very young, very successful, and he's already had surgery. My colleague Philip Alexia was here with the latest on this British superstar.
All right, VOA 1 host Ray McDonald here to talk about Mr. Sam Smith, who had some surgery, this great singer. What's going on with him?
Hey, Phil. Well, he may have won multiple Grammys and sold about 5 million copies of his album, The Lonely Hour, but the man went under the knife last week, or the laser, as the case may be. Back in April, Sam Smith began canceling shows after his doctor told him he needed surgery for a vocal cord hemorrhage. Now, of course, as you know, vocal cords vibrate against each other to produce sound. And when a blood vessel bursts, it causes bruising. Now, the reason for this? Well, we're not exactly sure. It could have just happened at a party where he raised his voice. Or it also could have happened because of the type of singing Sam does. Sam hits very high notes. He really gets up there. And this causes some additional stress to the vocal cords. Whatever happened, the doctor said, you have to cancel your shows, you have to get into the hospital. And that's exactly what happened. He underwent surgery last week at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And the good news is he's expected to make a full recovery.
Now, this is a young guy.
Yeah, and he's
23 years old.
He's in his early 20s, you know. He has his whole career in front of him, and the doctors are saying this should not unduly affect him. His voice may be different going from here on out, but he's in good hands. The same doctor who operated on Sam also worked on Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, Lionel Richie, and Adele. All of them have come back stronger than ever. The downside for Sam is that he's not allowed to sing or even talk for the next 3 weeks. And he was all over Twitter saying, how am I going to do this? You know, I'm a loquacious guy. I love to sing. I love to talk. Yeah. This is going to be tough for me. That's par for the course because, like any other muscles, the vocal cords need time to heal. His next live show is scheduled for July 18th, and let's hope he's okay for that.
All right, so he's a four-time Grammy winner, if I have that right.
Right, right. And it's tough out there for a professional musician. These days, touring is your most assured route to riches. So you got to go out there, you got to sing, you got to be at the top of your game night after night. Dr. Michelle Yagoda of the Lenox Hill Hospital in Brooklyn says it's like playing the World Series nonstop. And she says Sam Smith's voice will likely change in some form after this procedure, but it'll probably be for the better, and he'll be able to hit those notes more clearly. He's going to have to take care of himself, though.
Good luck to you, Mr. Sam Smith. And once again, VOA One host Ray McDonald. Thanks a lot, Ray.
Hey, thanks a lot, Phil. Here's Sam, by the way, back in the days when he could sing. This is his current hit single, Lay Me Down.
I'm reaching out to you. Can you hear my call?
There was a private service for blues singer-songwriter B.B. King Thursday night in Las Vegas, followed by a free musical tribute to the King of Blues. There'll be another memorial service on Saturday in Las Vegas. He'll be buried on May 30th in Mississippi. King died on May the 14th at the age of 89. Listen, everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Voice of America. Always good to have you with us for International Edition. The latest world news is coming up. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political turmoil continues in Burundi, with top government officials being dismissed following a short-lived effort by some military officers to take over the government. On May 17th, 5 days after the takeover attempt, President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree relieving the foreign, defense, and commerce ministers of their duties. Even as the president made his first public appearance in Bujumbura to show he was back in command, street protests continued there over his plans to run for a third term. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. Announcement of President Nkurunziza's candidacy triggered street protests, which police tried to repress with water cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. Estimates are that up to 20 people have been killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds detained over almost 4 weeks of demonstrations. Meanwhile, intimidation and violence by the ruling party's youth militia ahead of the planned May 26 legislative and June 26 presidential elections have caused tens of thousands of Burundians to flee to neighboring nations. The United States is deeply concerned by the potential for further bloodshed, including reports of retaliatory violence following the attempted seizure of power. We urge all parties to seek reconciliation and unity over revenge and retribution during this extremely tense period. We have acted to restrict travel for Burundian individuals who reportedly have committed human rights abuses and will consider additional measures against anyone who plans, participates in, or orders widespread or systematic discriminatory violence against the civilian population. The United States supports no effort by the military to take over power by unlawful means. We continue to believe that adhering to the compromises contained in the Arusha Agreement, including its presidential term limits provision, is key to returning stability and unity to Burundi. Thus, we hope that President Nkurunziza will weigh the best interests of his country and his legacy as he considers whether to continue his controversial bid for a third term. His candidacy will undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress. Some international donors have already cut or suspended financial aid. The United States welcomes the mediation efforts by the United Nations and African Union and urges all Burundian stakeholders to participate constructively to find a peaceful, democratic resolution to the current crisis. We particularly welcome the announcement by the International Conference on the Great Lakes Region of the visit of the presidents of South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania to Bujumbura in the coming days to meet with all parties. Burundi has come far since the end of the last civil war that caused so many deaths and human suffering. The United States reiterates its strong support for the people of Burundi at this very difficult time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.